Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, online at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the history of retirement villages in Florida.
This research points to the origins of places like the villages that are, you know, remain ubiquitous in Florida, even as they've changed, and there have been changes.
Two of the original African-American landscape painters known as the Highwaymen artists have died. Willie Reagan and R.L. Lewis both died during the last week of January.
But this art, what you see is the Highwaymen art. It was not art for the sake of art, just to put beautiful stuff up. It was art for the sake of, in some cases, survival.
And we'll go to the historic Gasparilla Festival in Tampa. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The Villages in Central Florida is the largest retirement community in the world, but as Sebastian Garcia reports, it is not the first in the state.
Dr. Anna Andrzejewski is the Frank Lloyd Wright Professor of Modern American Architecture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She recently delivered a presentation titled Building Florida's Elderburbs, the History and Origins of the Florida Retirement Village.
I coined this term elderburb in large part because of the close relationship that these retirement communities have in Florida to suburban housing developments after World War II. It's not an accident that what I'm calling the elderburb resembles suburbs because the people who built these spaces were suburban home builders for the most part who really adapted the form to their particular audience, that is older adults. And so I chose this term because, yes, they were for retired individuals, but again, their form is mutation or tweak, if you will, of the post-war suburban housing developments.
Suburban home builders like James Rosati shifted their focus to elderburb building in Florida in response to the changes in the post-World War II market.
Rosati and other builders shifted to this growing clientele of older adults. It was very carefully timed, I should say. So after World War II in the 1940s and 1950s, Rosati and other builders were building almost exclusively for returning GIs. These are the GIs that got sand in their shoes during World War II. They might have trained here or somehow known about Florida through their military service and then afterward had benefits from the GI Bill where they could be homeowners. And so there was, you know, all these people flocking to Florida, low interest or no interest mortgages with low down payments. And so Rosati and other builders were building directly for this audience. But then by the mid-1950s, the veterans market had largely dried up. There were still veterans, of course, and there were still benefits, but it was much smaller than the audience they had in the late 40s and early 50s. And so builders were casting about for new audiences. Rosati himself in 1955, really, when he sort of conceived of Orange Lake Village, he was like, I'm going to try to build for older adults and see how that worked. And he was not the only one. The Mackel Company, General Development Company that developed Port Charlotte, was part of this group. And there were other retirement builders as well. We think about Cape Coral, built by the Rosen brothers. That's another one that comes into play. Lehigh Acres, invented by another team of developers. All these developers were sort of like, who am I going to build for at this point? And by the mid-1950s, it wasn't veterans. It was largely in Florida anyway. It was retirees. And so they pivoted, if you will, to meet this market.
These builders drew on three distinct sources of inspiration when developing Florida's retirement villages, starting with the trailer park model.
I make an argument about this, that they drew on three separate, but I would argue interrelated sources as they sort of tweaked the form of the suburban housing development for older audiences coming to Florida. The first was, quite strangely, the trailer park. And trailer parks proliferated in the first part of the 20th century, especially in the 1930s and 1940s, as a space for vacationers and retirees from the East Coast and the Midwest to enjoy when they came down for vacation or sometimes seasonally. So I'm really talking about the tourist trailer parks as the source for this. And so these spaces, yes, they were temporary and fleeting. One brought their trailer or camper down to spend a week or two or sometimes longer in these spaces. But the reason they were so important to builders like Rosati was that they were spaces that had an array of community amenities. They typically had recreation centers. They had amusements like shuffleboard courts, swimming pools, these sorts of things, as well as sort of small lots. So it was this combination of emphasis on having your individual lot where you parked your trailer, but also having these community amenities. And so when I interviewed a descendant of James Rosati, one of his sons, Joe, a few years ago, Joe said, "We drew directly on the trailer park formula." And that was because the whole idea of having your own individual lot and having these community amenities worked perfectly. They just made, in Joe's words, "We made the trailers permanent houses."
The growing field of gerontology, or the study of aging in older adults in the mid-20th century, constituted the second source of inspiration which these Florida elderberg builders drew from.
A second source is related to that, and that was the growing field of gerontology. Really quite new in the mid-20th century, and Florida was a hotbed of gerontological research at this time. And builders not only participated in conferences from the University of Florida's Institute for Gerontology, they seem to have been actively reading the proceedings, reading about it in the papers and also reading the journals, and they would try ideas that were offered in these journals, particularly the recreational programs that were talked about at these in this literature about keeping adults active in retirement. And so builders really took ideas directly from that growing field and incorporated that into the organization and operation of their communities.
The final source that inspired these builders was the Florida state government, particularly its efforts to control the rising elderly population during this time.
And lastly, a third source was the state government, which was deeply invested in the whole phenomenon of retirees flocking to Florida. It wasn't so much that the state wanted to grow the elderly population so much as they wanted to manage it, to actively manage it. And so the state gave recommendations about what an ideal retirement community for adults could look like, called the Neighborhood Village. And they also produced abundant literature through the Florida Improvement Commission, disseminated to retirees in other states about what it took to retire in Florida financially and what that looked like. And so it served as a way for the state to control the kind of migrants that it wanted in the state, which they were very clear they wanted someone to be middle class, to be able to or to aspire to live in a home of their own. The state was like, we don't really want them to drain our resources. We don't want them to become a burden on the state because they moved here and couldn't afford it. So how can we build housing that meets them where they are, that meets their needs? And so that's why the state came up with this plan that they called the Sponsored Neighborhood Village as a model. Because the whole idea of it was, you know, small houses, small lots, all ideas that you see in places like Orange Lake Village, small houses, small lots with ample community amenities that they could enjoy. And so for the government, this kept pensioners off of sort of the welfare rolls at the same time, meeting their needs in a way that, you know, sure, it might grow the population, but it grew it in a way that was manageable for the state and for the state budget in particular.
In addition to using the exterior form of suburban neighborhoods as a model for their elderburbs, Rosati and other builders also modified the homes themselves to meet the needs of their elderly clientele.
They made changes to not only the subdivision form, but also to the houses. So they made the houses smaller. And they did this for a couple of reasons. One was affordability. People living on a pension or Social Security benefits, they had regular income, but that did not necessarily mean it was high income. So they wanted to make the houses cheaper. And the way to do that was to economize on materials and to make the floor plans smaller. So at Orange Lake Village, for example, Rosati built the houses shorter to economize on materials, so used fewer concrete blocks. So instead of the customary at the time, and usually code dictated 10 coarse blocks, 10 blocks tall, he built them at 9, and that saved 10% of materials cost, which Rosati claimed to pass on to the consumer. Whether or not that's actually true is open to debate. But they also made the houses smaller. So they figured if it's one person or two people living in this house, why not have a one-bedroom house or a two-bedroom house? So you had a bedroom for the individual or couple living there and then a room for guests. There were also measures taken to economize on living areas like living rooms and kitchens to save steps. Rosati became very interested in ideas coming out of home economics in the period that were about ways to economize the number of steps the housewife took, for example, to clean their houses. And so builders were drawing on that literature as well and thinking about how that pertained to housework in older age. So these are some of the steps that they took to really rethink the housing forms. So again, suburban in a lot of ways, but also really carefully adjusted to accommodate for older age.
Most of these early Florida retirement villages also included a Florida room in the homes, leveraging and manufacturing the appeal of Florida leisure living.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention another feature, an add-on that one could get with these houses, which was the ubiquitous Florida room, which was a big feature in these houses that was marketed specifically to appeal to this idea of Florida leisure living. You had a Florida room, you know, to be able to enjoy and commune with the out-of-doors. And this was heavily marketed to visitors to Florida who might be interested in purchasing a retirement home. The Mackle Company and General Development really played up the Florida room in all of their advertising to try to lure older adults because it was like, hey, you can live in Florida, you can have this special space, you can enjoy the weather. And so that was also a feature that one could customize at Orange Lake Village and elsewhere.
When I asked why her research on the history and origins of Florida retirement villages matters, Dr. Andrzejewski outlined three reasons.
The first reason I think this is important is that Sun City is often talked about as the first retirement community. Not true. Sun City, Arizona, the executives that were helping Del Webb develop Sun City, Arizona, actually visited Florida, visited Mackle communities in particular. There's a report in the Sun City, Arizona museum that talks about what they saw in Florida communities. So Del Webb, when he built Sun City, Arizona, which opened in the early 1960s, was based on Florida retirement villages, these elderburbs that I'm talking about. Secondly, I think this research matters because there's this dominant view of what post-World War II suburbs looked like, that they were for commuters, that they were for families, that they used mass production techniques to streamline, to make them big, that they were heavily car dependent. And I wanted to show that where these suburbs were built, as well as who was living in them, affected the form and features of these subdivisions. So there are different kinds of subdivisions for different populations, and those vary geographically, as well as by the specific populations that they served. But in the case of what I'm talking about is Florida elderburbs, the form and features specifically developed because of the retirement audience that they served. And so I think it invites us into thinking about diversity of form in these subdivisions that we talk about largely in terms of Levittown as one thing. And finally, I think this research points to the origins of places like the villages that are, you know, remain ubiquitous in Florida, even as they've changed, and there have been changes. But there's a legacy here. And I think that formula that the builders that I talked about today devised of, you know, these private quarters surrounded by these community features that encourage and engage active retirement. That's still very much with us and still very much a part of these newer places that we see today that are thriving in Florida.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Sebastian Garcia, a graduate history student, FHS media production assistant, and history podcaster at the University of Central Florida Department of History. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org to find great books on Florida history and culture, listen to archived episodes of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. With the death of R.L. Lewis on January 26th at the age of 84, and the death of Willie Reagan on January 30th at the age of 86, only two of the original 26 Highwayman artists remain. The Highwayman artists are a group of largely self-taught African-American painters known for their colorful Florida landscapes. Original Highwayman artist Alfred Hare shared his technique with Harold Newton, who in turn inspired both Willie Reagan and R.L. Lewis to paint. As Willie Reagan told us in 2009, Newton was from the African-American community of Gifford, just north of Vero Beach.
I used to deliver the Miami Herald newspaper around through Gifford, and Harold Newton's family was there, you know, and I got to know him by watching him paint. As I delivered the paper around through Gifford there, wherever he lived, you know what I mean? Sometimes I would catch him, you know, out with Upson board. That's what we painted on at that time. He would have a sheet of Upson board and he would nail it upside the house, you know, or put two nails down and lay it on there and then maybe put another nail at the top and bend it over, you know, to hold his Upson board up over, you know. And he used a sheet of glass, you know, to mix his paint on. And he started out with his white paint. And then whatever color, you know, whatever, if he was doing a daytime scene, you know, he would use, I guess, his blues and browns, you know, earth colors to make his sky and his water. You would seascapes that he painted, you know.
While many of the Highwayman artists knew each other in the 1960s and 70s, they were not part of an organized group. The term Highwayman was coined by art dealer Jim Fitch to describe these regional artists. In his 2001 book, The Highwayman, Florida's African-American Landscape Painters, Gary Monroe identified the 25 men and one woman who could collectively be called Highwayman artists.
In 1980, when their practice flattened, most of the artists had careers to fall back on. A few of them didn't. The core group, in fact, didn't. They were full-time artists. After Jim Fitch named them, and a couple years later, my book comes out, and the artist hadn't painted in 15 or 18 years. And all of a sudden, one after the other, they're picking up paintbrushes and painting again with a renewed interest from the public. People just flocked to the paintings, to their exhibitions, and there was a renaissance. And they're still riding that wonderful wave today, and people are still discovering this trove of indigenous Florida art.
In 2004, the 26 original Highwayman artists identified by Gary Monroe were inducted into the Florida Artists Hall of Fame. That recognition helped to bring attention to the work of these talented artists. Pieces once sold by the side of the road or secondhand at yard sales were now being displayed in galleries and museums. The late Willie Reagan.
I'm one of the 26 originals, and I was in an LLC with several of the Highwaymen, and we had a luncheon wherein we were already inducted into the Hall of Fame, but I guess it had to be ratified by the act of Congress, you know, a witness by a congressman. So we had a luncheon, and this is when we were awarded the medallions. And the congressperson had to be present, you know, to I guess, to ratify, you know. So this is what I'm wearing today. This is my induction into the Hall of Fame.
In the 1960s, when the highwaymen were getting started, Florida was racially divided. In some cases, the beauty of the highwayman art opened doors that would usually be closed. Gary Monroe.
It was a very rough time for African Americans. It was a Jim Crow South, and Fort Pierce was a pretty tough community. And not one artist ever told me that they had any trouble. And they were selling to a white clientele. They would knock on strangers' doors. They would sell to professionals, doctors, lawyers, accountants. They'd go to the banks. They'd go to the telephone companies. And not once did anybody ever report an incident of racial discrimination.
R.L. Lewis was the only original highwayman artist from Cocoa, Florida. Most of the highwaymen were from Fort Pierce. While the highwaymen are recognized as noteworthy artists, theirs is also the story of creative people making economic opportunities for themselves in a difficult period of racial segregation. The late R.L. Lewis.
The way I look at it is this way. If you got to survive, you'll survive. I don't care what it is. Tough times don't last. Tough people do. So that's one way to look at that. But this art that you see is the highwayman art. It was not art for the sake of art, just to put beautiful stuff up. It was art for the sake of, in some cases, survival.
Highwayman artist R.L. Lewis died on January 26th at the age of 84. His fellow highwayman painter, Willie Reagan, died on January 30th at the age of 86. The art of both men lives on. This is Florida Frontiers. On the last Saturday of January, Tampa prepares for a pirate invasion, complete with cannons, beads, and hundreds of thousands of people lining the streets. Claire Macchiarola takes us inside Gasparilla, where history, legend, and a whole lot of pageantry collide.
It's cold and windy. But that doesn't stop hundreds of thousands of people from flooding downtown Tampa. They come for the beads, the cannon fire, and if we're being honest, a little bit of debauchery. Every January, the city doesn't just throw a parade, it stages an invasion. This is Gasparilla, Tampa's most famous tradition and the only day of the year where pirates take over the city. But the story of Gasparilla and the pirate behind it is a little more complicated than beads and broadsides.
So the history of Gasparilla is a little complicated. My name is Rodney Kite Powell, and I am the director of the Touchstone Map Library at the Tampa Bay History Center. The kind of shortest way that I've been able to explain it is it's like Mardi Gras, but without the Catholicism. It really is a series of parades that's based around a crew, or now multiple crews, just like in Mardi Gras. The twist, though, for Tampa is we've kind of replaced the religious side with piracy. And it's based on a legend of this pirate named Jose Gaspar, who, despite the best efforts of historians for generations, no one's been able to verify if he ever actually existed. It's this kind of odd party where we're celebrating this criminal, but it's not super unusual. You know, we've kind of picked the romanticism side of things and kind of dismissed the bloodthirsty side of things to really celebrate this pirate, but what it really celebrates is Tampa.
Because in the end, Gasparilla isn't really about a pirate. It's about the city that adopted him. The first Gasparilla dates back to 1904, when Tampa was still growing into a modern city. That same year, the Ye Mystic crew of Gasparilla was formed, the first and still the largest crew in the parade. Over time, more followed. By the 1960s and 90s, new crews began popping up across Tampa. Women-led crews, Black and Latino crews, and groups that reflected the changing face of the city. Today, there are nearly 100 of them. Each crew is part social club, part performance troupe, and part family tradition. And Gasparilla doesn't start on land, it starts on the water. Every year, members of the Ye Mystic crew sail into Tampa Bay on their own pirate ship, firing blanks and cannons as they invade the city. An hour later, the parade rolls through downtown. For a lot of people, that level of spectacle is what makes Gasparilla different from any other parade in the country. But for the people who come every year, Gasparilla isn't just a parade, it's a ritual.
You gotta come back here and see the masses.
Tampa native Michelle Taylor has been coming her whole life. And for more than a decade, she's been part of a crew herself.
It's called KQAR, or the Crew of Queen Anne's Revenge. So it's named after Blackbeard's ship. We come here at 10 on the day of Gasparilla. Everybody's getting their armbands and stuff, drinking cocktails, and there's big breakfast, so everyone gets a good base. That's really important.
For her and her crew, the day starts long before the first bead hits the pavement. One of the biggest transformations happens in the costumes. Each crew has its own look, and no two outfits are exactly the same.
I'm Nicole Polsky. So we're inspired by the women of the French Caribbean, and our symbol is the fleur-de-lis. So that's what makes us all united. So we all have them on the back of our costumes. But as you can see, there are no two costumes that are alike.
Some outfits take months to design and build. Some cost hundreds or even thousands of dollars. Corsets, feathers, leathers, gears. Gasparilla fashion is part pirate, part pageant, and part Tampa. Dani Hinks and Haynes caught my eye.
So I tried to do a steampunk inspiration. So I've got the gunmetal gray mixed with the chrome trim, trying to make it a little edgy, rock star-y. With the brown, which I think kind of resembles a leather corset, and then bright colors on my skirt kind of tie everything together with gears.
For a lot of people, the costume isn't just something you wear. It's how you show who you are.
So for an entire week, everybody is into Gasparilla. Everybody's excited. There are pirates in the city. You walk around, everybody's dressed like we all are, and it's just a really fun time.
For 1 week, Gasparilla spills into everything. Storefronts, classrooms, offices, and neighborhoods. Pirates show up where you least expect them. And suddenly, the whole city is in on the same joke. It's easy to look at Gasparilla and see just another wild Florida party, but underneath the beads and the cannons is something older, and a little more personal. It's a story Tampa's been telling itself for more than a century, about who belongs here, about how the city's changed, and about how a pirate who may have never existed became a symbol everyone shares. Every January, Tampa doesn't just remember its history. It puts it on a costume and throws it a parade. For Florida Frontiers in Tampa, I'm Claire Macchirola.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Sebastian Garcia and this week, Claire Macchiarola. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.